Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For the Penn State football program, it's as if 14 seasons never happened, at least none of the wins, all vacated as punishment for the Jerry Sandusky child sex abuse scandal. And the list of disciplinary actions goes on. The NCAA, it seems, has had enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 23rd day of July. The NCAA fined Penn State University $60 million today. The money part of the penalty for what NCAA Chief Mark Emmert called the tragically unnecessary child molestation scandal involving one of the school's coaches, Jerry Sandusky. Beyond that, the college sports governing body voided the team's victories for the past 14 seasons and banned it from postseason bowl games for 4 years. Beyond the big fine and the serious damage to the university's reputation, the financial impact is expected to ripple across the area's economy for years. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Don't tell the people who live in and around State College, PA, that it's only a game. Penn State football is a key part of their livelihoods. Last year, average attendance was more than 104,000. When those people flock to home games 6 or 7 weekends each fall, they also pack restaurants and stores. Hotel rooms can go for $300 to $400 a night, which explains why Betsy Howell is grateful the football program wasn't suspended outright. She heads the Central Pennsylvania Visitors and Convention Bureau.
I think this is a harsh penalty, but it could have been worse had they taken away their opportunity to even play at all.
How much would that have cost the local economy? By one estimate, the football program generates more than $160 million in business every year. That might be easier to make up if the team were located in Los Angeles or Chicago. But at the University of Chicago, sports economist Alan Sanderson says it's not so easy in a small town. Now the games can go on, though. Loyal fans and alumni could, at least initially, help soften the blow.
If 80,000 fans show up instead of 100, and you're still employing about the same amount of workers inside the stadium and contiguous to it, hotels, restaurants, it's not like nobody's going to go to the games.
Sanderson still worries that 4 long years of reduced scholarships and weakened recruiting efforts could yet end up being bad for business.
One has to admit straight up that Penn State won't be as competitive on the field for several years, many years. Are people willing to come to watch I don't want to say inferior product, but a less stellar product than they have in the past?
Sanderson says the program could end up with a kind of death penalty, death by 1,000 cuts. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks fell on more worries about debt problems in Spain. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It's been almost 4 years since Lehman Brothers went under and the world's financial system started to spin out of control. The fall of 2008 was all about Henry Paulson's bazooka, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, $700 billion in bailout for the banks. The bailout legislation created a special inspector general at the Treasury Department to oversee where all that money was going. Former federal prosecutor Neil Barofsky performed the job until he resigned early in 2011. Now he's out with a tell-all book of his experiences in Washington, including the time he was pretty sure Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner was about to haul off and punch him. It's called Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. Neil, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I have to tell you, reading this 4 years after the fact, it's amazing to remember that the original TARP document was all of 3 pages, and it was completely designed to help homeowners by buying up troubled mortgages.
There's a remarkable transformation of the bill as it made its way through Congress. And it's important to remember that this was part of the legislative bargain, that TARP doesn't get passed just to help Wall Street, that Congress insisted that there be foreclosure prevention and homeowner-oriented programs as part of TARP. And those promises are, of course, subsequently abandoned. And part of it was there was never the same type of ferocious commitment to helping homeowners and addressing the housing crisis as there was to saving the banks.
You talk about TARP essentially becoming just a giveaway. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Well, when the TARP money was expended, hundreds of billions of dollars were provided to the banks under the capital purchase program. We were told that it was for certain purposes. It was going to help restore lending. And one would assume that since those were the goals of the program, that when providing the money in the contracts and in the policies, there would be something to advance those goals. But none of that was present. So essentially, the money was given with a very below market interest rate and with no conditions to accomplish those goals. And the banks were pretty much allowed to do anything they wanted with it. And, you know, when I started pushing back on that and when I suggested that we needed to have some additional conditions, I was told essentially that I was advocating something that would drive the banks out of the program, that I would end TARP. I was told that I was stupid. I was told that I was being political. And it's just another example of this deference and defense of the banks over what were some pretty basic common sense policies to accomplish our goals.
I want you to explain the concept of reputational risk for us. Essentially, this said that banks would not commit fraud with TARP money because they would be too concerned about their reputations to do so, right?
Over and over again, I heard that argument that I didn't understand, just that these banks would never, ever take advantage because of it would harm their reputations. It was almost as if they didn't realize that in the years preceding the crisis that the banks proved their reputation was perhaps the least important thing when it came to the opportunities to make rapacious profits. I mean, it got so bad, Tess, at one point in another TARP program that a New York Fed official said to me when we're describing Treasury's refusal to adopt some really basic concepts to rein in the TARP participants, he said to me, "You know, Neil, it seems as if Treasury's lips are moving, but that the CEO of one of the big investment houses, Larry Fink, that his words are coming out of their mouth."
To be fair, this was a crazy time back in 2008, 2009. Financial Armageddon upon us. No one seemed to know what was going to happen. So it's easy to criticize now, but can't you maybe just believe that people were trying to do their best under very difficult circumstances?
Tess, that is actually part of the fundamental problem. The lack of diversity in thought, the fact that so many of these individuals come from a Wall Street background, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, meant that when confronted with a crisis, they went with the only thing that they knew. Hmm. You know, I don't think that these people are necessarily fundamentally evil or bad people or sinister. I think they're patriotic people who went to serve their country at a time of a financial crisis. The problem is they don't know anything else. Like, they just don't know anything other than, wow, if this is what the high lords of finance are telling us is the best thing, then therefore it must be the best thing. And what's good for Wall Street is good for America. And that's why when we have another financial crisis, we're going to have these same problems.
Would you ever want to work in government again?
I don't really think that I'm going to have too many opportunities after this book comes out. But look, I'd love to serve again if the time was right.
Well, let me ask you this. What was harder to go after, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces down in Colombia, which you pursued as a U.S. attorney, or TARP?
There were a lot of similarities, but at least at TARP, nobody tried to kill me.
Neil Barofsky is the former Special Inspector General in charge of oversight of TARP, also known back in the day as SIG TARP. His new book is Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you're feeling bad about yourself and aren't sure why, well, take a look at your Facebook page and Twitter feed. There are about a billion studies out there saying people feel more depressed after looking at social media. Unfortunately, commentator Beth Tytel can relate.
Oscar Wilde once said that a true friend is someone who stabs you in the front. I'd like to update that. These days, a true friend is one who doesn't post a picture of your double chin on Facebook. She always likes your status updates, even when they're annoying. And she retweets your tweets to her thousands of Twitter followers so your clout score doesn't fall. We'd all love a pal like that, wouldn't we? But who has time to think of others when we've got our own online personas to curate? Happy and successful people have always made the miserable feel more miserable. But the upbeat used to have fewer platforms. They struck mainly in person and could only deflate one victim at a time. You were in the most danger at weddings or reunions, where the more fortunate would make you feel lousy about your kitchen or children or lackluster volunteer activities. But before social media, at least you had time to prepare. You could diet, inflate your own resume, not go. Sure, we could step away from our screens, but we just can't. So we carry our phones with us and check in constantly, lest we miss the news of someone's promotion or Nantucket vacation. And every update makes us feel worse. It's like a morphine drip, only in reverse. Give me another hit. So what can we do? I propose a Fairness and Personal Branding Act. For example, every time you post a photo of your family enjoying themselves on a posh island, you must include a disclaimer. Paying for the hotel has caused marital discord, perhaps, or this is the only time little Jaden wasn't pouting. But until we all agree to disarm, I'm going on the offensive. Tomorrow, I'm going to bake organic cookies with my Harvard-bound children, which we're going to eat on our sun-dappled porch after we've saved a wounded bird, cured a disease, and sent money to people in a struggling nation. All while tweeting and uploading photos, of course. Friends, consider yourselves warned.
Beth Tytel writes for the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. I'm sure she'd love it if you'd friend her on Facebook and follow her on Twitter. Your thoughts on social media depression? Write to us at marketplace.org or, you know, tweet us. Coming up, our series Food for 9 Billion continues.
When you look at ponds like this and you see how the fish are feeding efficiently, this is going to be how the future will receive its marine protein.
How to make farmed fish sustainable across the globe. But first, let's do the numbers. Renewed fears about Spain drained markets today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 101 points, 0.75% to close at 12,721. The Nasdaq sagged 35 points, 1.2% to finish at 2890. The S&P 500 slipped 12 points, 0.9% to end the day at 1350. Higher borrowing costs for Spain may have spooked global investors, but it was a steeper-than-expected decline in earnings that ate into McDonald's. Shares of the burger chain slid 2.9%. Microsoft was still smarting from its first quarterly loss. Its shares declined 2.75%, pulling down the Dow. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.44%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. She'll speak at a symposium on ending genocide in the 21st century. The National Association of Social Workers 2012 National Practice Conference continues in Washington. And True Blood actress Anna Paquin turns 30. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The Olympic Games open Friday in London. Athletes from around the world are limbering up for the big event. But another now familiar contest is also well underway. The host country is having a big argument about the economics of the Games. Brits are wondering whether they'll see any sort of return on their $15 billion investment. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard takes the gold for this report.
If you want to gauge the mood of a city, it's not a bad start to ask a cab driver. But in London, the cabbies are up in arms. Here's more than 50 of them protesting. They hate the Olympic Games lanes, a network of roads reserved for the exclusive use of Olympic officials and sponsors.
I can't see any reason or any justification why these elitist people have the freedom of London to swan around as they were.
Jonathan Myers leads a militant group of cabbies. They're upset that, like all non-Olympic traffic, they've been excluded from the games lanes, condemned to ply their trade mostly on the minor roads of the city.
Take-ins will be down by anywhere between half and two-thirds. So it's going to be very difficult. People are going to be frustrated. They're going to get out of the taxi and walk. In fact, they're not even going to get in taxis.
Nevertheless, overall, the government says the Olympics will deliver a $20 billion boost to the British economy. But many Londoners are asking, what do we get out of the Games? This is Spitalfields, Britain's biggest fruit and vegetable market, not far from the Olympic Park. Some of the traders here, like Steve Scrivener, feel put out that they've not been allowed to supply the Olympic Park.
They could be buying... What have we got here? We've got boxes of mangoes for £2 a box in perfect condition. We've got strawberries, 30 pence a punnet. I've got best raspberries here, 40, 50 pence a punnet. Best English raspberries.
But he says the Olympic sponsors are not interested in his raspberries. They've lined up their own suppliers. Another trader here, Emin Mehmed, is also miffed about the Olympics.
It don't benefit anybody. So why they put it here, I don't know. I really don't know. It's a really waste of money, I think. And I just think it's going to be a lot of hassle.
The government says the Olympics have poured billions into the British construction industry, and Londoners will see a lasting benefit.
A great rainbow arcs over Bolton and down onto a giant steelworks where they're finishing the last huge girder for the Olympic Stadium.
Building the Olympic Park has regenerated a large, poverty-stricken and run-down slice of the East End of London. John Armit of the Olympic Delivery Authority.
What you've got now are nearly 3,000 new homes. You've got a whole series of fantastic sporting facilities. You've got a 100-acre park, the largest park that's been created in London for 100 years.
But Andrew Scott is not impressed. He's the Deputy Dean of the London Business School and comes from the area where the Olympic Park is located.
It's very hard to take an area that is disconnected, low income, and has a centuries-long bad status, and suddenly turn it into something prosperous and vibrant.
He says the Brits should stop trying to kid themselves that they've made a shrewd investment. They've blown $15 billion on a gigantic party, so just enjoy it.
I'm excited about the Olympics. It does tend to boost the happiness of the country. And sometimes it's worth spending money on things that don't boost GDP.
It had better be. The most wildly optimistic estimate suggests that the Olympics will boost Britain's GDP each year for a decade by no more than 0.1%. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wild-caught fish are one of the most environmentally friendly sources of animal protein on the planet. They're also far tastier than most of the farmed fish you'll find in the store. But today, just about half of the seafood we consume is not wild. It comes from aquaculture, otherwise known as fish farms. And while it still beats out other forms of meat when it comes to converting feed into flesh, it's hardly trouble-free. Today on our series, Food for 9 Billion, Sam Eaton takes us to Vietnam, where aquaculture farmers are searching for new ways to create a more sustainable fish farm for the future.
In the 1960s, Vietnam's late communist leader, Ho Chi Minh, encouraged the rural poor to dig fish ponds as a way to boost their nutrition. The small ponds were integrated into family farms where fish fed on agricultural waste until they became food themselves. The farmers then drained the ponds and fertilized their fields with the sludge before starting the cycle all over again, never buying a single bag of feed or fertilizer. Today's model couldn't be more different. This is the sound of feeding time at a catfish farm in the Mekong River Delta. Workers bang the floorboards on a raft and then pour 50-pound bags of commercial fish pellets, which consist mostly of imported soy meal, into the water. The surface of the pond explodes with fish so dense, it looks like you can walk across them. Fortunes are being made raising these native catfish called pangasius on an industrial scale. And entrepreneurs like 56-year-old Duong Noc Men are the new tycoons.
For me, this is about legacy, and the legacy I want to leave for future generations is the development of this aquaculture business.
In a single decade, Min has built an aquaculture empire. Today, his Pangasius farm, called Hung Vung Corporation, is Vietnam's largest, with nearly 2 square miles of fish ponds. Min also owns his entire supply chain, from the feed mill all the way to processing and packaging. This year, he expects to produce 200,000 tons of frozen fish fillets, most of which will be sold as catfish in Europe and the U.S. But for Min, that legacy he speaks of is about more than just numbers.
I think in the future, farmed fish such as Pangasius will take a special role in supplying food for the world, especially as wild fish continue to decline.
And he's not the only one who thinks so. Jose Villalon, who heads the World Wildlife Fund's aquaculture program, says Pangasius may be the perfect factory fish. It grows fast, and it can breathe air through its mouth if things get too crowded. And unlike carnivorous fish like salmon, it thrives on a mostly vegetarian diet.
When you look at ponds like this, and you see the production output of them, and you see how the fish are feeding efficiently, this is going to be how the future will receive its marine protein.
Intensive systems like this can feed a lot of people, but there's also the potential for things to go terribly wrong. Rivers get polluted, diseases run rampant, forests and wetlands get bulldozed into new ponds. This is why Jose Villalon and WWF are here in Vietnam, working with big producers like Min. They hope to create a new model for industrial-scale fish farms that puts the planet on equal footing with profits.
Right now, we're at this transition where aquaculture is being produced in traditional ways, and it's not yet being asked to be responsible.
But Villalon says it will be, as aquaculture is projected to double by the middle of the century. And for the WWF, being responsible means following the environmental standard it helped create. It's called the Aquaculture Stewardship Council. And in order to become certified, Pangasius farms have to do things like stock their ponds with fewer fish to reduce disease outbreaks and treat wastewater in sedimentation ponds before dumping it back into the river. But there are about half a dozen other certification schemes in Vietnam as well, all competing for the same business. And the jury is still out as to whether these voluntary standards will actually translate into real environmental gains.
The standards are what I would call set without evidence.
Roel Bosma is an aquaculture researcher with the Netherlands Wageningen University. He says the certification standards being touted by environmental groups set the bar way too low.
1 kilogram, the best, fastest growing. And they started at how much?
In a government lab outside of Ho Chi Minh City, Bosma and his Vietnamese colleagues are searching for ways to make fish ponds completely waste-free. They're experimenting with new feeds that make fish feces more solid so they can be easily removed and the water reused.
You can smell it different, eh? You can smell straight up. You don't smell it when you're around, but when it's concentrated like this, you smell the difference.
The fact that this fragrant brew gets dumped back into the Mekong River instead of being used as fertilizer for crops or as food for other fish drives Bosma crazy. He says it's a basic lesson in efficiency even the original farmers understood.
Farming systems in the past, they were mixed systems where the residues, the waste of one animal or one component of the system were reused by another component of the system.
Bosma says by treating the pond as a natural system rather than a factory, farmers can reduce both their waste and the need for costly soy-based feed, which has an entire set of environmental implications of its own. But he says this ecological approach is also more labor-intensive, making the model much more suited to smaller farms. The problem is only a few are left. As recently as 5 years ago, small-scale farmers produced the majority of the country's Pangasius. But today, after a wave of consolidation, they account for less than 10%, a number that's likely to fall even lower in the coming years. Trinh Van Teck has about 5 acres of Pangasius ponds in a remote village near the Cambodian border. And he says this year's harvest will be his last.
I already discussed it with my wife to change the business. Maybe after harvesting the fish this time, we change everything back to rice. Maybe we'll have just the rice field again.
Teck stands to lose more than $250,000 because of rising feed and labor costs. Like the industrial-scale farm I visited earlier, Tech's fish are also destined for foreign markets. But he says for him, the cost of complying with the new certification standards his buyers demand means the difference between a profit and going deep into the red.
If I want to sell my fish, I have to follow the international standard. Even though as a small farmer I have a harder time meeting the requirements, I have no choice but to follow them.
With the loss of Vietnam's smaller fish farms, the country may also be losing its best chance of adopting Roel Bosma's more ecological approach to aquaculture. Tech, for example, floods his rice fields with pond effluent instead of dumping it back into the river, fertilizing and watering his crop with the waste. And before the pressure to adopt environmental standards like WWF's, many Pangasius farmers used homemade feeds that included farm byproducts like rice bran and vegetables. They even used ground-up golden snails, a pest in their rice fields, as a source of protein. These practices may be more sustainable environmentally and economically than importing huge amounts of soy meal to feed the fish. But they would never pass the strict food safety standards required by big retailers in Europe and the U.S., where most Vietnamese Pangasius ends up, which raises another key question in the search for a sustainable aquaculture model. Who's it for? At a small fish market in the Mekong Delta, Pangasius is one of the cheapest fish you can buy, but there's virtually no demand for it in other parts of the country. So as the Pangasius tycoons like Duong Nguyen Minh focus on feeding the rich world in a more sustainable way, maybe the small producers, with their integrated farms, can focus on feeding the people who need protein the most, the world's poorest. In southern Vietnam, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, a bit of buzz in the caffeinated world of upscale coffee houses. Pete's Coffee and Tea has been sold. But if you think it's about to get a familiar green Starbucks awning, it's not. A German luxury goods conglomerate bought Pete's for $977 million, and it joins the high-end likes of Bally and Schumeister Jimmy Choo in the company's portfolio. Pete's headquarters will stay in Emeryville, California. And that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow fell 101 points, 0.75%. The Nasdaq sagged 35 points, 1.2%. And the S&P 500 slipped 12 points, 0.9%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Megan Larson. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.